Going to take over the presentation.
About 10 and 11?
I'm sorry.
10 and 11?
About 10 and 11.
10 and 11, yes, sir.
Paul, just need a little coffee.
Yeah, please do. Me too, yeah. Does anyone have a caffeinated beverage? Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and congratulations on your ascension to chair. And I also want to appreciate, you know, we're at the margins of your operation, but we also appreciated Brian's role as chair. We were involved in some of those, you know, controversial things, and we found Brian's hand on the tiller to be, you know, very helpful and very productive, just from our sort of outsider view. So we also would thank Brian for that. We are here, Paul Angelo with the CEO Company out of San Francisco, joined by my colleague John Monroe, here to present the December 31, 2014 actuarial evaluation report for the Contra Costa County Employees Retirement Association. This is a relatively benign report, which is reflected by the relatively small number of people here in attendance. You know, we've ever since 2008, you know, we've been delivering a series of reports that basically show higher costs, mainly because for 5 years we were phasing in through the smoothing method. We were recognizing those losses, and then, you know, the markets bumped around a little bit, but now we really have a couple years of good investment success, even though this year we'll see the market value return was actually slightly less than assumed. Because of the smoothing method, the earnings after smoothing was higher than assumed, and that combined with some other factors led to a reduction in cost. And, you know, we joke about the papers. You know, no one ever grabbed a paper off the stand because it says retirement board behaves responsibly. You know, that just doesn't sell papers. Same thing when the costs go down, you know, becomes a fairly low-impact discussion. We will go through in a little bit of detail how we reconcile getting from last year's unfunded to this year's unfunded, how we get from last year's aggregate cost to this year's aggregate employer cost. And then for those of you especially who are slightly new, this is a complicated plan and a complicated report because there's a lot of different rate groups. We'll show you a page that has a one-page summary of all the different employers. And then after that, the individual rates, the sort of the most detail on rates, which really shows every single variation, you know, whether a system or an employer made a special contribution that gives them their own rate. The pension obligation bonds don't affect all employers. So we'll go through that at the tail end of our presentation. And as always, we would invite your questions as we go through. With that, we'll jump in. Like most actuarial reports, it's kind of a pyramid format in that Section 1, which has Roman numerals for the page numbers, has an overall summary in text of what happened in this valuation. That's what we'll go through with you in detail. And then if you go to that in Section 1 and go to page single I is pretty much boilerplate. It talks about the purposes of the valuation. And then on page double I, which is Roman 2, in Section 1 at the top, it does mention what your amortization policy is. You pay off your unfunded liability, yet as you have your employers, that is, pay off your unfunded liability over 18 years. But each year, when we identify a new piece of unfunded liability due to either actual experience or an assumption change, that is isolated and paid off over its own separate 18-year layer. So you have what's called 18-year layered amortization. There's a schedule that shows that. That's what's at the top of double I. Then we get into the significant issues in the valuation year. And as is always the case, we start by talking about the funded status. That's the first bullet on double I. Then we talk about the average employer rate. And then on the next page, talk about the average member rate. And then we talk about anything that sort of happened since last year that was a little bit different in the valuation. And then we look at the effect of investment return, which is the principal driver of your cost volatility. So let's start there on double I in the middle, where it says that the ratio of the valuation value of assets of the actual accrued liability, the so-called funded ratio, increased from 76.4% to 81.7%. That's because you had basically favorable both investment and demographic experience. Now, you'll notice that the ratio on a market value basis also increased, but not as much. And that's because on a market value basis, you actually earned a little bit less than the assumed rate. And we'll look at that later when we look at the...
I'm sorry, my mistake.
You earned 7.35. Your assumed rate is 7.25. So you only earned slightly over the assumed rate. So you had a very small gain on a market value basis. Thank you, John. I'm so used to systems having assumed rates at 7.5%. When I see 7.35, I think loss. But you are not alone. There are now about maybe 6 to 8 systems in California that have 7.25 as their assumed rate of return, and that actually is now sort of the new range in California. Most systems are at 7.25 to 7.75. So I apologize for that, because your assumed rate is 7.25 and your actual return was 7.35. You had a slight gain on a market value basis, but a larger gain on an actuarial value basis that we'll look at on a later page.
Thank you. 1937 actuaries, all public pension systems.
All public pensions in California. In California.
That would make us a leader, right?
What's that?
That would make us a leader, right?
You are absolutely. California leads the country in public pension practice in many areas, not just the actual assumptions, but also things like funding policy. This use of layered amortization, less than 20 years, that is still relatively uncommon outside California. It is absolutely the standard and the most common practice within California. So that's always been the case. What's that?
What's the total amount of systems?
In California, big systems, there's the 2037 Act systems. There's about 6 big city systems. There's the 3 LA city systems. There's San Diego, San Francisco, San Jose has 2, and then I would say Fresno City. Those are the larger ones. So all told, it's probably maybe 30, of significant size. And there are some smaller ones. There are some small cities that have independent systems. But most of the smaller cities and jurisdictions are CalPERS agencies. Just like of the 58 counties in California, if you subtract 20, let's see, that leaves 38. Of the 38 non-SACRs, non-SERL, County Employee Retirement Law systems, of those 38 systems, all but 2 get their retirement benefits from CalPERS. And there's a good bar question. What are the 2 counties in California that are neither CalPERS nor 37X systems? Everybody know?
San Francisco.
San Francisco's the easy one. And?
San Luis Obispo.
Yeah, there's a veteran trustee. So, but as I say, within the, and actually I often describe in actuarial meetings that California provides almost a laboratory. When we had the 2008 market downturn, we were able to look at, 15 fairly similar systems and see how they digested, how asset smoothing worked. We learned a lot about asset smoothing because you get to run the experiment over and over again here in California. But there is a consistency of practice across California plans that, as I said at the beginning of these comments, is somewhat ahead of the curve in terms of national practice.
Paul, is San Luis Obispo self-funded but not PERS? Is that...
It's an independent system, yeah.
But it's not big enough to be in your group of 30. That's why they were not.
Well, no, for whatever reason, you're right, I neglected to mention them. I would throw them in there too. Okay. Yeah, so if we're talking a total of 30, I would throw SLO in there as well.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I'm actually not sure how large they are. They're smaller than the other big independent systems, certainly smaller than the LA City systems or San Francisco.
$4 to $5 billion.
Yeah, so that puts them, if you listed the 2037 Act counties, it would put them in the third quartile, at that size. Yeah. So they would be one of the ones to throw in there as well.
Okay.
So the valuation, the funded ratio, that is, did improve both on a market value basis and on a market value basis and an actual value basis. Now, what you'll see in our report on the left side are page number references. So when you're reading the report on your own, this is where you can find more information on these items. The reference to page 88, I'm not going to go to right now. That's a history. That shows the history of the funded ratio for the last 10 or so years. I am going to ask you to turn with me, though, in section 3 to page 68, which is where we will see a reconciliation of the unfunded actual accrued liability, how we got from last year to this year. So what we do is we start with, the unfunded last year was $1.8 billion, $1,823,000,000. And we first start with what would the expected unfunded be if everything happened according to plan? Well, what would happen is, first, you would accrue a year of normal cost. Your normal cost, that's the cost allocated to the current year of service only for active members. Only active members have a normal cost. Terminated vested members, retired members do not have a normal cost. And then we throw in the expected contributions. Now, the expected contributions are, what if the contribution rates from the previous valuation, December 31, 2013, what if they were immediately put into the plant, starting with evaluation date? That doesn't actually happen. There's actually an 18-month lag between the effective date of the valuation and the date that the rates go into effect. So, for example, the rates that you would be discussing and adopting today, even though we calculate them as of December 31, 2014, don't actually go into effect until July 1 of 2016, 18 months later, because it gives us basically gives us a chance to get the valuation done, and it also gives your employers a little bit of lead time in terms of knowing what the new rates are. So, but that's not the number that's in here. This is the sort of theoretical contribution that would have been made based on the valuation. Then we adjust everything for interest, and that leads to the fact that the unfunded liability would have gone down to about $1,773,000,000. Well, in fact, things don't happen according to plan. So then the next section there shows all of the actuarial gains and losses, all of the changes in unfunded liability because actual experience did not match assumed experience. So the first one is on the investment return. Well, now here, remember, a negative is a good thing because we, even though you might think of the unfunded liability as a hole in the ground, we calculate it as a positive number. We take the liability minus the asset. So a positive number is a debt. And so if you have a gain, it reduces the debt. So we actually had a gain because the actuarial value earned around 12%. Was that the number, John? 11.4%, and we'll see that in a second. On a smooth basis, your rate of return on an actual value basis was 11.4%, substantially higher than the 7.25 assumed. Turn that into dollars, and it's about $250 million. So right there, your unfunded liability drops by $250 million because of 1 year of investment gain on a smooth 5-year smooth basis. We also had additional contributions that came in from sanitary district. Throw that in there. Now, here is where, because of the 1 year lag, sorry, the 18-month lag, the actual contributions were less than the $380 million shown up above in line three. How much less? About $13.8 million. We've seen this fairly commonly in the last few years because if the rates are going up, which they generally have been doing since 2008, the rates go up, the 1 year lag means you're actually contributing less than our computer program thought you were going to. That goes the other way, though. Now when rates go down, we would expect, John, check me on this, that next year we might see a gain due to contributions greater than assumed because the 18-month lag works in both directions.
And what rate are you talking about?
Well, this one, we haven't seen the rates yet. This is the employer contribution rates that we're talking about. Employer contribution rates are implemented 18 months after the valuation date. And what we'll see in a second is that this year's rate that you will adopt today is less than the one that was that was in the valuation a year and a half ago, and that actually went into effect a week ago. Right? Okay. So the next item is. We all know that inflation has been very low for some years. We assume in our valuation that the members will receive the full COLA because our assumed inflation is at 3.25%, and the maximum COLAs in your various tiers are either 2 or 3%. I'm looking at John, get that right?
Most of them, yeah, are 2 or 3.
Right. Yep. And so if we have actual inflation less than 2 or 3%, that means that the COLA that's been granted is less than we assumed. And that produces an actuarial gain. In this case, that's a gain of about, where'd it go? About 43, the 25,084 is down there. Then the other thing that happened, now these involve salaries. When you have lower than expected individual salary increases, again, this is bad for the members, but it's actually good for the financial condition of the plan. You know, we project benefits forward based on each year's salary. We assume salaries are going to grow on the average roughly about 5% a year. There's some more details in there. But when salaries grow less than that, then when we get to next year, we're starting with a lower salary than we thought we were going to start from last year. So when we project the benefits forward, we're projecting a lower benefit. So this is the effect of lower than assumed salary increases on the individual members' benefits. That produces a gain of about $43 million. The other ones on here, so there's contributions. Then we have other experiences, always kind of an other number, which is in this case about fairly small, about $71 million.
$71,000,
yeah.
This is actually the smallest number I've ever seen in my whole career for another experience gain or loss.
There you go. So this is target shooting.
Smallest number, yep.
Okay. Yeah. Now, as I've learned in other cases, you got to be careful when you see that, because it could be a plus zillion in one direction and a minus 1,071,000 in the other direction. But it's not. It's really not. We poked around in there, and there's really this is at the noise level. Okay. Finally, there was a change in actual assumptions. John, what was that about? That was, I think, a refinement.
There
of
was a change pieces. To the leave cash out assumption for one tier that was adopted by the board earlier this year. A very, very small change. Yeah.
Yeah. You might remember, not only was there a decision, we'll see this in the notes later, not only was there a decision to include the leave cash out assumptions in the calculation of the basic member contribution rates, not only did that happen, but there was also a little refinement in the actual value of the leave cash out assumption for one group. And it was one of these ones where, since it looked like they couldn't actually have any leave cash outs, they'd been averaged in with somebody else, and so something bled into that assumption, so we unbled it and basically cleaned up that assumption. That leads to this $52,000 number. So those are all the unexpected things. It's easy to see what the drivers are. Clearly, investment return, by far the largest driver of both liability volatility and, as we'll see later, contribution volatility. And then the other two that went also in that direction were both sort of economically based, lower than expected salary increases on the active side, and lower than expected COLA increases on the retiree side, offset by some fairly small loss numbers. All that slices off another roughly third of a billion, $300 million off of the unfunded, and that gets us to the current unfunded of $1,469,000. So we start with that snapshot. Now we're going to look at how these same changes affected not just the funded status, but the next year contribution rate for the employers. Okay, so far, everybody nodding their heads. Good, I saw a nod, that's good. Okay, so now if we go back to section one. I think we're still on Roman two. Oops, I got last year's in here. I gotta be careful, I don't need those. So again, on Roman two, now we see the average employer rate calculated, excluding any employer subventions of member rates or member subventions of employer rates, both ways, you know, whether you have pickups or reverse pickups, those are not shown in these rates. This is sort of the, you know, right out of the statute, right out of the computer contribution rates. And on average, it decreased from 43.5% to 40%. And that is a striking result, especially for anyone who's been around here. It's not just since 2008, but since 2000. We've been doing working on plans like yours since around 2002. We came in right at the end of the tech bubble burst, a great time to get into the pension consulting business. And so we had 5 years of losses because those losses were recognized under smoothing. We just got out of that in the early 2000s. We thought things were looking pretty good around 2005, 6, 7. Then, Pam, here comes 2008, which made the tech bubble burst look like a cakewalk. Then we had 5 years of recognizing those. So it's really been pretty much our entire career with you of coming in here with bad news. Here we have the reverse of that, and we actually have a reduction in the employer average employer contribution rate of over 3% of pay. Now, it's always good. Just sneak ahead a couple pages. If you go to page Roman 5, you get a first glimpse at how complicated your plan is, because that 40.06, which is the new average, you'll see it on page Roman 5 right in the smack middle of the page. It's the bottom of the top banner where it says all employers combined, right in the middle, 40.06. Well, that is a weighted combination of a lot of different rates. I like to say there is no member in the plan for whom 40.06 is their contribution rate, right? That's only the average. What you can see here is for general, you got six different cost groups. For safety, you have six different cost groups. And within each of those, there's a whole variety of different rates that we'll look at in a second. I'm going to go back to show you where these details are in a second, but first I want to focus just on that average rate and see how we got from last year's rate, which you see is 43.58. How do we get from last year's rate to this year's rate? Just like we do with the unfunded, we're going to look at the effect of each of those. And so you know where to find that. Again, go back to double I, please. You'll see next to that bottom bullet where it says reference page 32. That's where we're going now. That's in section two of the report, and that's going to be a reconciliation of the aggregate contribution rate, just like we just now went through to reconcile the unfunded liability. So let's go to page 32. Excuse me. So now it's kind of the same idea. You'll recognize most of these items. We start with the average contribution rate from last year, which was 43.58. And now we look at what are the things that will make that rate go up or down. Well, everything that affects the unfunded also has an impact here. So some of these will be familiar. There's the investment gain loss. Remember, we had $250 million of investment gain on a smooth basis. If you take that, amortize it over 18 years, and divide it by payroll, you get about 2.6% of pay. So of the 2-plus reduction in the average employer contribution rate, you can pretty much say it all comes from investments. There's a lot of other stuff going on, but that alone will get you down 2.6%. Additional contributions from sanitary, of course, those do not reduce all the rates. Those only reduce the sanitary rate. We can tell sanitary that. We're very careful about that. Now here comes remember the lower than expected contributions, which was a loss? Well, that increases your unfunded liability. So here's the difference between actual and expected contributions due to the delay of implementation. That's the 18-month lag. You take that loss that was on the other page, amortize it over 18 years, divide it by payroll, and you get about 15 basis points. Now here again, with any luck, that number will go the other way next year. But that has tended to be a positive number. Now here come the other economic impacts. We talked about lower than expected COLA. I'm going to jump down to that one next. We have the dollar amount on the other page. Now we have the effect of that on the unfunded liability contribution rates, 27 basis points. Now next comes the first things that we didn't see before. If you go up two lines, effect of lower than expected individual salary increases. That one we saw before. Remember, we said because we're projecting salaries, if salary goes up less than assumed, we're now going to be projecting smaller salaries. That lowers the unfunded. It also lowers the contribution rate by about 46 basis points. But the next one, there's no analog for the next one when you reconcile the unfunded. Because what this is about is not whether the unfunded got bigger or smaller. That was the earlier page. This is when you're paying off the unfunded. If you think of the unfunded in dollars, the unfunded payment is a dollar amount, and think of it like your home mortgage, and suppose you got a cut in pay. Now, your mortgage payment in dollars doesn't change just because your pay went down. But if you think of your mortgage payment as a percentage of your income, if your pay goes down, and the mortgage payment stays the same, as a percentage of your income, it's going to look like your mortgage went up. Well, that's what this is. Because salaries are assumed to grow on the average at 4%, on the average, we assume that the employer's mortgage payments, their unfunded liability payments, they are amortized as a percentage of pay, so that their payments are assumed to go up at 4% a year. Well, if you are budgeting your next year's payment as a percentage of pay, assuming pay is going to go up, and if pay goes up slower than assumed, then the contribution rate will go up, even though the unfunded itself didn't go up. That's what that 33 basis points is. And again, it's the only thing on this page that does not match to something on the unfunded liability page. Now, I'm watching the sort of eyes glaze over effect here. This is something that we've seen a lot in the last 3 years, because if you're sort of counting on payroll growing at 4% a year, and payroll doesn't grow at 4% a year, well, actuarially speaking, the good news is that you're going to project smaller benefits. That's the gain here of the 46 basis points. But that is offset in terms of the rate, because you're now taking the unfunded liability and spreading it over a smaller than expected payroll. So in terms of contribution rate, you want to think of those two as going together. You've got a gain of 46 basis points because you're projecting smaller liabilities, but in terms of the rate, it looks like the rate goes up by 33 points just because you're spreading those mortgage payments, those unfunded payments, over a smaller than expected payroll. That's the most complicated thing we have to do here. And we've got a lot of practice having that conversation. People say, well, if pay goes up less than assumed, does that make my rates go up or down? And, of course, the answer is yes. because it makes them go up. Now, it tends to make them go down more than it makes them go up. You notice here that the 27 basis points, I'm sorry, the 33 basis points, which is the bad news, spreading it over a smaller than expected payroll, is smaller than the gain in the liability because of smaller projected benefits. That's the way it always works. So they do offset each other, but net-net, slower than expected salary increases will produce a gain and will produce a reduction in contribution rates. Okay? That's it. The other things on here we saw before, there's always an other and a 56 basis points. I like the fact the effective changes in the actual assumptions. John, I assume that's rounding. That is the 0.00, but it actually has a dollar cost. I think that's because it's that small.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, okay, that's rounding. And then here we have, now, here's another thing that we didn't see on the other page, okay? You took an action to change the way member rates are calculated so as to include in the calculation of the basic member rate something called the leave cash outs. Now, that does not change the member's benefit. So it doesn't change the liabilities. What it does change is the split or the sharing between the employer and the members. So there's no item on the unfunded liability page for the fact that you are now making the members pay more and the employer pay less, because the unfunded liability doesn't see that. But when you look at just the employer rate here, this again shows that on the average about 7 basis points of contribution rate was shifted from the employers to the members. And you had this number before you when we had that discussion about making that decision. So here again, another item that affects the employer contribution rate but does not affect the thing that it's funding, because it's more about how the cost is shared between the employers and the members. Okay? That again, part of our conversation with you over the last year. So those are the two hardest pages in here, basically the reconciling the unfunded and reconciling the contribution rates. Let me just pause. Any questions so far? I want to glance a little bit at the detail of the contribution rates and asset smoothing, but let me just pause for questions, okay?
I believe Pepper did away with subventions. Are these contracts that are still in effect? You mentioned subvention.
Well, again, this report does not reflect subvention. So the numbers in here are not affected by the fact that PEPRA now eliminates subvention. If they were, if these rates show the effect of the subvention, then you would see a difference, but they're not. All those calculations really are handled by CSERA staff outside the valuation report. So maybe that's a question to predict to either to Kurt or to Gail. The fact that PEPRA eliminates subvention, that is reflected in the actual rates that are charged to the members, but that calculation happens outside the actuarial report.
I seem to recall in the past that you would include, at least on one of these schedules, a second schedule that calculated it, including the subvention.
I think so.
That was some years ago. I mean,
it was like year before last.
We might have done that 2 years ago or before that. But we basically stopped doing it because it was our understanding that a lot of that subvention was being eliminated.
Do you know what's still left in terms of subvention? What contracts are still being?
Central Sand. Have all that information in member services. We have to keep track of every MOU and what the mm-hmm. subvention is, because we validate contributions as they come in.
So how many contracts are still left? And as Todd said,
not that many. We're getting rid of them.
We list in the CAFR something like 9 of our employers, including the county, still have some subvention.
But we're eliminating most of our agreements. It's not.
So just to be clear, then the chart 15, for example, that we see here, really doesn't include for purpose. Or actually, I think there's a breakdown of this chart by cost group, right? And so when we get to the, say, Central Sand cost group, we're not really seeing the true numbers.
And it works, both ways. There are employees that pay part of the employer cost, and that's also not reflected.
And which groups are those?
Mainly that's some of the fire districts.
Okay.
And the other safety members.
Okay. So what would it take to actually put that with subvention schedule back in? I'm not sure why it was ever eliminated.
It was in there assuming all the employers paid 50% of all the members' basic rates. And when that was the norm, it made sense. It was initially a county-wide decision to pay that 50% of the member basic rate. As now, it's certainly not the norm. The norm is much closer to no subvention.
Okay.
So it just didn't make sense to put it in. It just didn't reflect the reality.
There was a board discussion. I remember Richard distinctly saying, why do we even have, there wasn't a vote on it, but there was a discussion, him saying, this doesn't reflect the vast majority of the employees, and there was no disagreement that I recall hearing. So
one place that you can see the actual, when you look at the financial, the actual member contribution and the actual employer contribution, that does reflect all the subvention. So you can see, based on the rates, what the expected member and employer contribution is, and you can see the actual. And
in the one that's broken down by cost group? So I guess my concern is that our employers would look to this document to get their numbers for their budgeting, and if it doesn't include the subvention, then the numbers might not be completely accurate.
I can't speak for like the county or others, but we're well aware of the costs and budget for it accordingly.
Yeah, my sense has always been that because there's such a range of subventions, that the actual information that the employers use for budgets comes from the retirement system, and it has all the subventions, but it's a much longer list.
Well, the employers tell us what the subvention agreement is.
Right.
We reflect that when we collect contributions. So these are the rates as determined by the actuary and the statute. What is the member portion and the employer portion? And what actually happens is really between the employer and the bargaining units. And we just make sure we collect the full contribution.
Okay. Okay, anything else?
No.
Yeah. So if we go back to, actually you don't even need to go back to Roman 2, because the next page we're going to look at is the very next page, which is the reconciliation of the employee rates. That's on page 33. It's a much shorter list because it's affected by much fewer things. First of all, there were no changes in assumptions. Well, there was that little bitty change in assumptions, but it rounds to less than 0.01% for the one group that was affected by it. And then here's the same 7 basis points. This is the increase because of the change in the way the leave cash outs are reflected in the rates. We saw a savings of 0.07 for the aggregate employer rate. Guess what? Here's the mirror image of that. And then there was other experience of about 14 basis points. Some of this, you still have some rates that are based on entry age for the legacy tiers, right? And so just the change in the demographics of the group will make the average rate change, even if it doesn't necessarily change any individual rates. So this has that in it. And then also, were there other, any actual changes in individual
what
member
see
rates?
Here, what we're seeing here, what we'll see over time, is members, when new members are hired, they're in the new PEPRA tiers that generally have lower employer contribution rates and lower member rates. So as we saw on page 32 and also page 33, there's another item here. It's a reduction in the rate. And that's because of over time, each year we're going to get more members in the new tiers with the lower rates. So it's just a shifting of people in the tiers over time.
Right. But that means that there's no individual whose rate went down by 14 basis points. It's that here's a bunch of folks whose rates didn't change. Some of them left. They're replaced by folks with lower rates because they're in the PEPRA tiers. So the average goes down because the demographics is shifting, not because the individual rates go down. That's the only point I'm trying to make.
Those leave cash outs, if I understand, that's no longer being offered. So it's just people are like grandfathered in. So every evaluation will adjust it accordingly.
Yes and no. I mean, there's still employers that have leave cash outs. There's still people that have leave cash outs. It's being phased out for the county, but it's not gone. There's still leave cash out assumption.
But they understand they're no longer offering it, though, right?
For new, current, yeah.
So as the people retire, terminate, whatever, that'll eventually end up going away?
Mm-hmm. For county.
For county. Other agencies may still allow it.
Got it.
And we already assume that it's zero for PEPRA members because there's no leave
right,
cash.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons that you see this shift in the aggregate rate going down, again, as less expensive folks, either because of the lower formulas or because of no leave cash outs, replace the more expensive members in the legacy tiers. Okay. Let's look a little bit at some of the detail. If you go to page 19, now there's no particular bullet to go with this, but if you go to page 19 in section 2, this is sort of the introduction to the detail in the member in the employer rates. This starts to give you a sense of where all the different cost groups and cost and rates come from. Here we see listed for general the six cost groups. Remember we saw on the summary page on Roman 5 there were six cost groups. Here they are. Tells you which employers are in each of the cost groups. And for each of those, there are two benefit structures. There's an old benefit structure, generally Tier 1 enhanced for more Tier 3 or Tier 3 enhanced, and then that's replaced by either PEPRA Tier 4 or PEPRA Tier 5. So if you look at the actual number of rates, it's twice as many as you see here because you've got the Tier 1 enhanced rates or Tier 3 enhanced rates or Tier 1 non-enhanced down at the bottom, and then you also have the PEPRA tiers. On the next page, similar for county safety. Again, we saw there were six. Not for county safety, for all safety. There are six cost groups, and we can see here, even like county safety alone, there are two legacy tiers, Tier A enhanced and then Tier C enhanced for members hired on or after January 1, 2007, but of course before PEPRA. And then you see Moraga, San Ramon, and Contra Costa Fire, East Contra Costa, and Rodeo Hercules. Now, and then again, for each of these cost groups, there's actually more than one rate because there's more than one benefit formula. So, if you go to the next page, just to give you an idea, just for County Cost Group 1, you can see the number of different actual rates. So on this page 21, there's 1, 2, 3, 4 of them. You'll notice that, for example, there's Tier 1 with POBs, Tier 1 without POBs, Group 1 is with the courts. You've got first five is with the unfunded liability. So anytime you have an employer that has a different relationship to their unfunded liability than some other employer because they made some special payment, this is where their separate treatment shows up. Next page, we're still doing general cost group one, but now we're going into the PEPRA tiers. There are the four different PEPRA tiers. And then finally, when you're done with all that, you get to a county general, a last one there at the top of page 23. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 different actual separate costs, all that are falling in within what we would call cost group one. Other just little things to notice, look at the top of page 21. I'm just picking this as an example where it says general tier one with courts. You'll see that the UAAL rate is 15.07. There's a reason I'm drilling down on this. 15.07, but the normal cost is 15.39 for a total of 30.46. You see where we are there? It's the third column of numbers. 1539, 1507, 3046. Now, turn just to the next page, look in exactly the same spot, and you'll see a normal cost of 10.94. UAAL 1507, exactly the same number, and then a total of 2106. So if someone asks you, where's the cost savings for the new PEPRA tiers, this is where you can see it. It's all in the normal cost. The reason that the normal cost on page 21 is 1539, whereas on page 22 it's 1094, that is entirely because the old legacy tier has been replaced by the new lower benefit, lower cost PEPRA tier. However, the unfunded liability payment is spread and shared over both of those. Because what you don't want to do is have your unfunded liability for the old tier paid off only over just the old tier salary. Why? Because as that salary gets smaller and smaller, as a percentage of pay, that number will start to blow up. So what we do whenever we're pricing a new tier, we assume that the new folks in the new tier are going to have the same unfunded liability payment as the old folks. So in effect, the unfunded liability includes both tiers, and it's only the normal cost that's separated. And that's what you can really see pretty clearly. You'll see that all the way down. Anytime you have two contribution rates that are the same, except one is legacy and one is PEPRA, you'll see the same unfunded liability payment, but the different lower affect only the normal cost for the PEPR tier. So that's just a good place to see how the unfunded liabilities are pooled, whereas the normal costs differentiate between the two benefits. Other than the fact that there's a lot of numbers in here, this is where I think, again, except for the pickup issue, a subvention either way, this is where the employers would go to get a sense of what their individual rates are, because they know who they are, they know where to find themselves. Then all that gets averaged together. If you go all the way down, if you have sufficient stamina to go to page 31, the last line of numbers there, third column over, 40.06. You remember 40.06? That was the average aggregate rate for the whole plan. There it is. And if you go over three columns, four columns, there's the 43.58. So we started out talking about the aggregate over all the different cost variations. This shows how that total is derived from each individual cost group. Within each individual cost group, anywhere from 4 to 8 different benefit formulas. Okay? Last thing is let's look at asset smoothing, and then we will close our prepared remarks. Going back to section one, because it's where we live, but we've now made it to page triple I, section one. I'm at the bottom of page triple I, where we talk about asset smoothing. I like doing this part because I remember back in 2009 when we talked about asset smoothing, it looked pretty scary. There were a lot of losses that we were not yet recognizing. That is now reversed. So I always like to point out, this is the second bullet from the bottom on page triple I. The way asset smoothing works is when the assets, you have to use my hands here, when the assets earn more than assumed, the smooth value is going to be lower because it's deferring some of those gains, like rainy day money. When the assets earn less than assumed with losses, then the smooth value is higher. That means you're deferring losses, which means you're actually doing the valuation with more money than you really have. I don't know what the reverse of rainy day money is, but that's what it is. Well, that's what we had for many years after 2008. But now we can say the total unrecognized net gain, underlying the word gain, is about $250 million, $336 million. Now, last year it was even higher. Last year it was over $500 million. That's because we had a smaller market gain this year, and so we've now recognized more of the past gain, so the numbers come slightly closer together. But it still means that over the next four valuations, if the fund earns exactly 7.25% on a market value basis, we are going to see gains to the tune of $336 million. That's what that paragraph says. Well, that's kind of esoteric, so we try to come up with a way of saying, what is $336 million in gains look like in numbers that we can understand? Okay, that's at the top of Roman 4. If we were to take that $336 million and bake it into the cost today, which we are not recommending, but if you did that, then that average rate, I'm going to the second bullet, that average rate would decrease, from 40.1 down to 36.5. So it's about, 3.5% of pay. That's the reduction in employer contribution rates that you can expect over the next 4 years as that $336 million makes its way into your cost. You can also do it in terms of funded ratio. Your funded ratio on a market value basis would be 86%. We mentioned that earlier, instead of 82%. Now, for those of you who were around in 2009, that was when we first introduced these bullets. At that time, instead of having a deferred gain of $250 million, we had deferred losses of in the order of $1 to $2 billion. I don't remember how large it got, John. I think it was certainly over $1 billion.
So,
and so Siegel actually introduced this and said we have a mandatory bullet that says when you have big deferred losses, and we say your contribution rate is 40% of pay, we have to say, but if we did it on a market value basis, it would be 50% of pay. And it was that big. And we were asked at the time, okay, actuary, when this goes the other way, when the market number actually looks more favorable than the smooth number, are you still going to have this bullet in here? And we said yes. So that's why I'm going through this. So you can see this is where smoothing actually makes you look prudent, because you are actually doing the valuation based on not all the assets you have. And if you were to mark to market, it would actually make your rates go down. But you understand, from our standpoint, these are two sides of exactly the same coin. You would expect that half the time you're going to be deferring losses, half the time you're going to be deferring gains. Happy to say that this year, just like last year, we are deferring gains, which makes you, as I say, if you went to a market value basis, it would even be a lower contribution rate than is proposed for adoption today.
The point of it, though, is to remove the volatility year to year so that you have employers and employees understanding and expecting what rates are, particularly employers, for budget.
That's exactly right. We give you a couple hints on that. If you go in section 2 to page 5, and by the way, this is similar information that you get from your staff, from Kurt and his staff, on the market stabilization reserve. What's listed here on page 5, total deferred return, that's the 336. I think the terminology for your interior reports is market stabilization reserve. Kurt, is that still what you're calling it?
We call it just a total deferred return.
Okay, very good. So there it is. This chart shows where it came from. Unfortunately, even though you do 5-year smoothing, because you do your interest crediting in 6-month periods, it's actually 10 6-month periods. That's just to make it impossible to actually read here. So you almost have to group, you know, 2 6-month periods together to see what your annual effects are. But what it does show at the very bottom is how that $336 million is going to show up over the next 4 or 5 valuations. You're going to have a gain. Again, this is if the market value earns exactly 7.25. This shows the rollout of the $336 million. It's a little bit front-loaded because some of your gains happened right after the tech bubble burst, and those are now getting to where they're being fully recognized. And then you had a couple lost years that come after that. That's why you have a little bump up in 15. But this gives you the idea of actually how those roll out. And then what we also do, what John prepares every year, is we take this information and actually for each cost group do an estimate of how that will affect the employer's rate each year over the next 5 years. So we actually take that and do a sort of a simplified cost projection to translate that into contribution reductions each year for the next 5 years. And John, those are usually released sometime soon after the value is adopted.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so that's an automatic task that comes right after the valuation is adopted by you as a board. Again. Last thing on asset smoothing, this really goes to the comment that was just made about how we manage volatility. Most folks like looking at page 8 because page 8 shows the smooth value, which is in that sort of orangey color, the triangle, and the market value, which is the gray squares. Here you can see the 2008 downturn. You know, remember, each little line there, each little space is $1 billion, right? This is real money. So that's the downturn. And then you can see until 2012 was the first time the numbers crossed. That's where we went from deferring gains instead of deferring losses. 2013 was a big one. Remember, that was about $500 million. Now 2014, it's about $250 million. I actually find it easier to look at more the rates of change rather than the dollar amounts. And for that, the last thing we'll look at is on page 11 with a graph on page 12. This actually shows the rate of return each year, both on a smooth basis, which is what's called actuarial value, and on a market basis, which is called market value. So there you can see in the most recent year, the market return 7.35, which would be a small gain, but the smooth return is 11.39. Well, but look at the year before. In 2013, the market return was 15.5 minus 7.25 is a lot. We recognize that over a 5-year period, which means we deferred 4/5 of that, and that's why the smooth return is only 9%. So last year, you actually earned 15.5. The smooth value is 9. This year, it goes the other way. And if you want to see a picture of that, you can look on page 12. Page 12 shows the rates of return. Again, gray is the market value. You can see the housing crisis roller coaster there. Almost negative 30%. Remember 2008? Yeah. Then after that, there's a recovery. A couple good years. 2011, you know, back down again. But this shows how the rate of return on a smooth basis follows the contour of the market returns. It's just smoother. So, again, this goes to the trustee's comment that this is how we actually manage cost volatility over the short term, but still track market value for the long-term cost of the plan. With that, Mr. Chairman, that concludes our prepared remarks. We would invite any questions, and then the next item is action to adopt the report and the rates.
Okay. Are there questions?
1 year. What's the next opportunity we'll have to revisit the interest rate assumption?
I believe at the beginning of next year. Is that?
That's when it's scheduled for.
Yeah.
We do it at least every 3 years.
Yep, but that'll be the next thing we do to adopt assumptions for the next valuation.
For the next valuation, it takes effect, yeah.
And that would be for the 16 valuation or the 15?
The December 31, 2015.
15, okay.
Yeah, we do a review of all the assumptions at least every 3 years, but if you look at this report and last year's report, we actually did change an assumption. You can, place an item on the agenda anytime you want to look at an assumption.
Right.
Yeah, no, when John was here, I don't know, a month or so ago, I asked the question about the long-term view of the change in the cost of living and the basis for that 3.25%. Understanding that wasn't the time to discuss it, and now is not the time to discuss it. I just wanted to know when.
It's our next action, yeah. So it's scheduled between this valuation and the next one. We will review that. And I don't mind telling you, and John, you may have alluded to this before, when we review your assumptions, economic and demographic, they are all very much based upon your particular plan experience. The only exception is price inflation. Now, price inflation is most important as a component of other assumptions. It's a component of investment return, and it's a component of salary increases. But because it is a national macroeconomic statistic, we, as our practice in San Francisco, at any point in time, there is a price inflation assumption that we use consistently for all of our plans. And beginning with 2015, beginning with the studies that were done this year, we are now recommending 3%. So that's the only assumption I can tell you in advance that's what your report will show. It will show 3%. And so even if there are no other changes, that alone would put downward pressure both on your salary assumption and on your investment return assumption. That we will then, of course, look particularly at your asset allocation, your risk margin, and your confidence level, both of which are parts of our model that you might remember from when we went through this probably 2.5 years ago. But we do know, we can tip our hand a little bit here, that the price inflation component that we will recommend will be 3%.
Thanks.
Can you just briefly comment on page 35, the volatility ratios? It would seem to me, if I understand this correctly, that we're getting better, but we still have a liability volatility of 11.5%.
Okay. Now, by the way, I forgot something. There's something new in here on page 35. You're the first ones to see this. Because if you look at last year, we showed the volatility ratio, but only and the asset volatility ratios only for the plan in total. This statistic is somewhat ironic. It's an important statistic that actuaries have not yet figured out what to do with it. We know it's important, but we haven't figured out a way to convey what exactly it carries. The idea of the volatility ratio is that if you have, for example, a 10% drop in your assets, okay? And if your ratio of assets to payroll is 10, well then a 10% drop in assets is going to equal 100% of your payroll, which means that putting aside smoothing and amortization, eventually you're going to have to come up with additional costs equal to a full year's of payroll. Whereas if your volatility ratio, if your ratio of assets to payroll was only 5, which would be typical for some general tier plans, then the very same 10% drop in assets would only equal 50% of your payroll, which is still bad, but it's a lot less. So what this does is it gives you a general sense of how sensitive your cost rates are to big changes either in assets or liabilities. It's really useful as a relative comparison. But this will touch on something. If you've ever gotten the sense, for example, when we recommend an assumption that leads to higher cost and you adopt it, the safety rates seem to change more than the general rates. That's what this will show. Let's look at the liability volatility ratios. What you saw in last year's report was just the last column. And what this shows is that, 2008 it was 8.5, now it's 11.5. That means that if anything happens to change your liabilities, like, for example, a change in your earnings assumption, the percentage impact in terms of payroll has gotten up, has gone bigger over the years in the proportion of 8 to 11. So whatever it was, use my same example. If you had a 10%, if you had an assumption change that changed your liabilities by 10%, back in 2008, that would have represented about 80% of your payroll. Whereas in 2011, it represents 110% of your payroll. So the same decision, the same change in liabilities looks bigger because, relatively speaking, your liabilities have got bigger relative to payroll. That's what this is trying to show. What we put on here this year for the first time was we took that volatility ratio and split it between general and safety. So if you take your general liabilities and divide them by general payroll, you get 8.6, kind of like what the full plan one was back in 2008. Whereas, hang on to your seats, if you take your safety liabilities and divide them by safety payroll, you get 23.5%. Which means, go back to my example, if you had an assumption change that changed your liabilities that increased them by 10%, that would represent 86% of your general payroll and 235% of your safety payroll. So you can expect that the effect of that same decision, the same assumption change, the same percentage change in liabilities, is going to look about 3 to 4 times bigger in terms of the effect on the safety rates than it does on the general rates. Now, this is new, so I've never done that. John, did I get all that right?
Yep.
Okay. So that's what this is trying to show, is that the same event will have a different multiplier effect on either your plan over time, because the volatility ratios are increasing over time, or it'll have a different effect on general versus safety, because the relationships between liabilities and payroll are so different for general versus safety.
And what's made it raise over the years? What are the factors?
There's two main things. One, well, first of all, the fact that the benefits are larger. I would say over time, it's really the plan getting more mature is part of it. Because after all, the more retirees you have, the more liability you have compared to payroll. The other, though, is, especially on the liability side, is generally the trend to more conservative assumptions, right? There are two big assumptions that everybody talks about. The earnings assumption, and lately the mortality assumption. Both of those assumptions are only moving in one direction, right? The expected return over the last 10 years has gone from around 8.5 to 7.25. So that's in here, and every year the mortality assumption seems to get a little bit longer. So it's really, I would say, Gabe, more conservative assumptions are making the liabilities grow relative to payroll. That would be the effect on the liability side.
You went to 7.25. Where is that reflected in what year?
That if you look between 2011 to 2012, you can see the jump up both for general and safety.
That's right. That's the exact right question. Okay, well, thank you for pointing that out, because this really was, we've been talking about what to do with this, and our idea was, well, at least if we showed it for general and safety, it gives you a better sense of how this can show relative cost relationships within the same plan. I will tell you, CalPERS was one of the first ones to throw this number around. Now, this is anecdotal, but I remember Alan Milligan saying, generally speaking, you know, CalPERS has a lot of agencies, right? They got the 30 counties, they got a lot of cities, and he would say, generally, you know, an asset or a liability volatility ratio in the range of 4 to 5 is considered low, and in the range of 10 to 12 is considered high. Okay? 23. So, again, now, Milligan made the same comment. The safety tiers within CalPERS tend to have the higher ratios. Now, this comment was some years ago, and CalPERS has also been lowering their discount rate and lengthening their mortality tables. So my guess is that his high and low stats are going to be a little bit bigger. But I think that to have a volatility ratio in the 20s goes a long way to explain why everything that happens seems to have a bigger impact on the safety rates.
Is the amortization years also affecting this?
It does not. It does not, because this is just the liability, not how fast you pay it off. So that's actually completely separate. Another good question.
So it's really the higher rate for safety, is that because of the higher benefit?
Fundamentally, yeah.
Well, one of the things that strikes me is that going from 2000, I'm on the asset volatility ratios at the moment, going from 2008 at 5.3 in total to 2014 at 9.9, we've had a steady increase. And I suspect, for the most part, the increase has occurred because payroll has not increased, if at all, relative to assets. Okay?
Yeah.
So if payroll had increased relative to assets, we'd have a much flatter system. Is that good or bad? I'm not quite clear yet on what it is I know now that I know this. We have a real trend on this one.
Depends who
you
are.
We try to avoid value judgment like good and bad. I would say it is adverse. So it's in that it means more volatility. But this is also fun. You know, we tell the story about it in L.A. City. Before 2008 downturn, L.A. City has two big plans, at three in total. They have a general plan called LACERS, and they have a safety plan called Pensions. Before the market downturn, their safety plan was 100% funded, whereas the general plan was 80% funded. You know, the market downturn, they lost 22%, like everybody else. Guess which plan got hurt the most? The plan with more money. The better funded plan is going to be more volatile. So what this shows is that as the plan gets closer to 100% funding, and by the way, when you get to 100% funding, you know these two ratios become equal, right? Because if your assets equal your liabilities, then the ratios are the same. The closer you get to 100% funding, the higher your asset volatility ratios, and therefore the more volatility. So it really isn't good or bad. It's just an awareness that the bigger the plan is, the more volatile it's going to be relative to payroll. So when you talk about, you know, the fact that salaries did not grow but assets did, what that means is that every percentage change in assets going forward is going to look bigger as a percentage of payroll. If volatility is defined as bad, then that's bad. But for us, it's just a matter of awareness of what is your source of volatility and what are the relative volatilities for your different costs.
Thank you. Any further questions? If not, do I have a motion?